case. I believe at the time of that oral argument, the issue was raised whether high blood pressure and the treatment of high blood pressure was discrete from the treatment of an occluded artery. If the condition was discrete, then the operative day of limitations would have run from the date of examination in which the doctor failed to diagnose occluded arteries. At the time of the Roundtree versus Hunsucker case, this court could not conclude that the treatment was discrete, and accordingly began to operate under the high blood pressure, under the prescription medication issue, focused on that, concluded that the prescription medication could not be treatment that is a subject of the claim because it was discrete, and then held that the operative date would be the last day of visit to the doctor's office, which of course was to get a high blood pressure check, because that time period was more than 2 years before the day of filing the suit. The court held that the statute of limitations effectuated a bar of that of Ms. Hunsucker's claim. In this case, the court has medical testimony in the form of Dr. Chambers' affidavit indicating that the conditions for which he treated her after June of 1986 were discrete. And if I can approach my exhibit for a second.
So the court understands the operative date. This is a failure to diagnose case in which the argument is you failed to diagnose my breast cancer. Ms. Conaway alleges that in November 1st, 1983, she saw Dr. Chambers, said, I've got a lump in my breast. He refers her for a mammogram. The mammogram comes back negative. He tells her your breast looks fine. Then it comes to May 13th. During this time, there are 25 visits because they have a general physician-patient relationship. Those 25 visits have nothing to do with the breast implants. They are for other matters, including treatment of high blood pressure and other illnesses. May 13, 1986, on her own initiative, without mentioning to Dr. Chambers any of her prior complaints with the breast that had developed between this three-year period, she goes and gets the mammogram. Dr. Reedy reads the mammogram, sends a courtesy copy back to Dr. Chambers, who on June 16, 1986, looks at the mammogram, which is admittedly negative, says the breast looks fine. From that point on, June 16, 1986, there is no further treatment, and that's the treatment of the breast. The treatment was simply for flu, colds, and a urinary tract infection. And there were three visits over that time period. There were four visits to the office for high blood pressure, but three visits where she saw Dr. Chambers, and that was for the flu, and urinary tract.
But let me ask you a question with regards to the substance visits for other ailments like the flu and cold, etc. Doesn't the doctor have a continuing duty to monitor the situation?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it does have a continuing duty. That gets into standard of care, not limitations, in my judgment. You're going to be talking about limitations, but the issue of whether there's a continuing duty to monitor. For instance, Dr. Squirrel's affidavit was given, in which he held a legal conclusion that there was a continuing duty to monitor. To me, that's a standard of care issue, not a limitation issue. As to whether the statute provides that for limitation, it defines it either as to the wrongful breach or as to the treatment that's the subject of the claim in the last set of treatment.
But under your theory, couldn't a physician diagnose a breast cancer in 1983 and intentionally failed to treat any more for that condition for 2 years and have limitations run?
That's true. That's true. I think you get into other issues with the fraudulent concealment. But the counter to that is, can a patient come back later on, even though she was treated 2 years earlier and the doctor just made it, obviously, determined there was no breast cancer, and she's treated for the flu and the cold, she decides I'm going to intentionally go back to that doctor for an examination of my flu, and then that would bring the whole statute of limitations all the way down.
Of course, the statute of limitations and the standard of care are intertwined, aren't they? I mean, whether or not there's a duty to monitor, there's a duty to follow up, whether there's a duty to refer, those sorts of things. Speak to a standard of care relating to continuing duty, isn't that intertwined with the question of when limitations ought to run?
maybe intertwined when you get to standard of care, but if I understand statutory guidelines for limitations, it's breach
or last that treatment, when that treatment's completed.
Why isn't the failure to follow up, failure to monitor, failure to refer, a breach?
Because the doctor makes a judgment here that there's no breach. From that point on, you've got to react.
Hadn't they detected a lump in her breast?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
In the earlier, back in 1983, hadn't they detected a lump in her breast?
That's the point.
That's why the first mammogram was run to test to see whether it's positive or negative. That's obviously she had some concern that on her own initiative she went out and got a second mammogram, which we reviewed. But I'm glad to see things are still clear. During the course of the following course of treatment at any time, did he monitor that situation to see if that lump had ever become malignant?
No, Your Honor, he did not. In 1983 and 1983, there was no treatment of the breast.
Was that up to snuff as far as his duty to his patient?
Well, again, I like to get into duty as to the issue of standard of care. Well, I see duty, that's standard of care, and that's what Mr. Anderson aptly argued throughout. I'm looking at limitations. The limitations on this issue is defined in terms of wrongful breach.
Say you can meet the appropriate standard of care during the course of treatment over a period of time results in injury to the patient. Would that not bring it within limitations because it was a failure to meet the standard of care that was by definition the malpractice that results in injury for you? What?
See, the statutory intent was a two-year statute running from the date of the failure to treat the condition complained of.
I don't think you'd have a problem if after May the, or June the 16th, 1986, he never went back. But you said earlier that they had a continuing doctor-patient relationship and he was her general practitioner and provided all the medical needs, basically what you say.
Well, see, in the court
this is the one she looked to keep her health.
I concur with you,
Your Honor. I mean, there'd be no, we wouldn't even be here if they'd never come back. But if what the court
But if they detected a lump, they tested, they were concerned about that. You know, it doesn't, a lump is there, you have a mammogram, it's negative. 2 years later, you have another mammogram, it's negative. That doesn't mean it's always going to be negative. The lump is there.
Uh-huh.
And normally, you think that a physician would continue to examine that on every office visit and
would follow up.
And the failure to follow up, if it results in injury, if indeed it becomes, the lump becomes malignant as opposed to the mouth, if it results in an injury, requiring radical surgery or resulting in death. Seems like there's some injury resulting from, is that not malpractice by definition?
It may well be the failure
to follow up on a detected possible medical malady.
Sure, that may be, as the court defined that may be, and you realize that limitation, when we get into standard care, we're going to be arguing all that. Right now, we're dealing with limitations. And I'm looking at Article 10 of 4590I, 10.01, which has legislative intent of an absolute two-year statute. That's first. We know that. Secondly, the Court of Appeals, when faced with this decision that you're talking about, came back and said, we cannot create an unlimited statute of limitations for doctors merely because there's a general physician-patient relationship. And this court in Roundtree versus Hunsucker adopted that premise, that the mere presence of a general physician-patient relationship will not operate to indefinitely extend the statute of limitations. And what the court's talking about is when the treatment ceases, when the treatment ends for the particular condition complained of, in this case breast cancer, then the plaintiff it cannot do indirectly what they can't do directly.
The argument here is not that it ended, it's that it never was initiated.
I know.
But what they've done is they've come back and they said, you didn't do it here, you saw me and February. You didn't do it here, you saw me in January. Even though there was no discussion of it, there was no treatment of it, there was no conduct indicating that there was going to be treatment of it during that time, there was no action taken whatsoever because the doctor said, I don't think you got breast cancer. back here in June of 86. If you're going to create that premise that now they can use omissions and they can tap onto that general physician-patient relationship and bootstrap their argument to then create a whole new area that every time
you omitted to do this, you omitted to do this, you omitted to do this. Even though the physician's made a judgment, there is no breast cancer, then you're going to create unlimited statute of limitations, and Article 4590I 10.01 will be abrogated as to really all, for sure as to internists, for sure as to primary care providers, but you can easily see what's going to occur. Orthopedic surgeons treat patients for back-related complaints 5 years ago, and some of that patient comes back, sees them for a knee complaint. You know, does that then, the entire time as he continues to treat for that knee complaint, he now held to an obligation to say, how's your back doing? Or is the patient held to an obligation too? Does the patient have a responsibility to say, look,
there's a misconduct test. I've got an inverted nipple that wasn't there before. I've got structure and painful breast. I've got a lump that goes from the size of a marble to a grapefruit, which all occurs during, after this day. When she wants to get it treated, where does she go? She doesn't come back over here on March 16th when she decides I'm going to have it checked out. She doesn't come back to change it.
Does the record reflect when she decided to go to the Texas Health Center where the diagnosis was actually made? But the record also says that there was, he was observing symptoms prior to that time.
Yes,
was he observing these symptoms at the same time that she was going to Dr. Chambers?
Yes, Your Honor.
But was deliberately not saying anything to him about this condition?
I think it more appropriately expresses the understanding that she did not regard him as treating her breast. I don't know that I could say she deliberately didn't do it, but she concedes she didn't tell him.
But she never told him, even though she was in there anyway, and she had observed the difficulty.
That's right. That's
and
right.
So when she really became concerned about it, she went to the other doctor at the Texas Health Center.
Well, I think she was concerned about it during this entire time. She testified to that. She just never mentioned it to Dr. Chambers. There was no real question, why didn't you ever mention it to Dr. Chambers, that I recall during her testimony. But what she says is eventually her family told her, let's go get it checked out. And she went March 16th, 1988, was her testimony to the University of Texas Health Center.
It wasn't clear on the May 13th mammogram. She didn't have Chambers do that. She did it on her own,
right,
and then provided Chambers.
Right.
So on May 13th, her second mammogram was done under some other authority other than a referral from Chambers.
Right.
She just provided it to him, or maybe the laboratory provided it to him.
The radiologist provided it as a courtesy to Chambers because he was reflected as her family.
And on June 16th, the only thing that occurred is he made some sort of comment that her breast was fine, apparently some sort of follow-up having received the mammogram. But she didn't request him to do a second mammogram, though.
No, you're correct. And in fact, his office was the treatment of the loop, and he just got a copy of it and made a passing comment.
And you're saying in the best case scenario for respondents here, the best case scenario is that maybe June 16th could have been considered a treatment, but from a review of all the facts, the only treatment he did was back on November 1st of 83 when she complained, he requested a mammogram, did some follow-up, and as far as Dr. Chambers was concerned, any affirmative request on her part or affirmative action on his was well done before she independently sought a second mammogram on May 13th, and he reviewed it and made some comment to her, but not at her request.
That's correct, Your Honor. Given her the benefit of the doubt as to any of the summary judgment as to any possible time of treatment, the last possible time of treatment of breast was when a passing comment was made.
These facts are undisputed.
Yes, Your Honor, they are.
And so, in Roundtree, we said that when a cause of action accrues is a question of law, not a question of fact.
That's true, Your Honor.
And so, the Court of Appeals, you would argue, is wrong in remanding the case for a new trial based on the question of fact, when confronted with our opinion around it.
Yes, if I can elaborate a little bit, yes, I consider the Court of Appeals wrong when they reversed and remanded for new trial. The Court of Appeals, frankly, followed the round three opinion in theory all the way up to the final point. And I think had the Court of Appeals had the benefit of round three versus Hunsaker, their decision would have been different. But round three comes up after the court has rendered its decision. But the court basically adopts it all and says, this can't be considered a wrongful omission. You can't use this wrongful omission to sit down and argue that that becomes an operative act of human tort because you've got to have conduct.
Well, so there's, but the problem is in a doctor-patient relationship, you can have a non-feasing by the doctor, failure to diagnose, a failure to monitor, a failure to refer. And this scheme doesn't really work under that scenario because it would require the doctor to perform an affirmative act and would be negligent in performing an act, wouldn't it?
I think it's what the limitation statute requires. There's got to be treatment and or wrongful conduct. But what they're basically arguing is a continuing tort theory that operates on omission.
Why isn't that a breach? When the legislature uses the term breach, why isn't that, doesn't that include non-feasance by the doctor?
Because two reasons. One, the clear legislative intent that it be a two-year statute that this court has already determined. And number two, you've got to have treatment of the condition you complain of. And that's what Ken Kimball said. You've got to have some treatment of that breast.
So the statute never begins to, I mean, so there's no negligence under that statute unless there's an affirmative act of negligence. Is your position?
That's right. I want to add that the Court of Appeals, in answer to your previous question, the Court of Appeals followed that all the way through, and then they said, we're going to make this some kind of subjective intent. The physician has to tell them they've terminated treatment for the patient, or the patient has to say, I terminated treatment for the drug. But they conceded all the factual information. Had they had round three, where this court said, here's the way you determine whether the continuing treatment ends, one, by looking at the physician-patient relationship, and two, the conduct. Was there any examination? Was there any attention to attend to the patient for the condition? Was there anything in the future plan?
Thank you.
Question. Any other questions?
Roger Anderson will present argument for response.
May it please the court, in response to the court's questions, we beg to differ with counsel with regard to the undisputed nature of these facts. I think in analyzing this case, it is extremely important, particularly in light of the factors that the court has set forth in Roundtree, to review the relationship between this lady and the defendant, as well as the relationship between the various health care providers that were available to her within the community. The defendant was the sole source of her medical care, her general medical care, and it is undisputed that he recognized and was aware of her seeking no other medical attention other than himself or his referrals during the period of treatment that did not end until January of 1988. The trust that existed there, the practice between the doctor and the patient, for example, with regard to conditions such as high blood pressure, her blood sugar, the doctor used his medical judgment to determine when the test should be done, what types of tests should be done. He did not depend or wait until Mrs. Conaway made some specific complaint or asked the doctor, you know, please test my blood sugar today. I need my blood pressure checked today. He used his judgment to determine as he treated these conditions of which he had noticed. And there's no dispute that he had noticed that she had a lump, a problem with her breast, that it prompted her to seek these diagnostic tests.
Well, apparently she didn't place total reliance on him during this period. After the mammogram on November 1st, 1983, 2.5 years later, she apparently unilaterally went out without consulting him and had an independent mammogram performed. But he wouldn't have known about it all had the reviewing physician not provided him with a courtesy call.
The, Your Honor, according to the deposition of the hospital representative, Kathy Jones, Mrs. Conaway would not have been allowed to come to the hospital and present herself with a mammogram without a referral from the treating doctor. And the procedures that they used at the time that the second mammogram in May of 1986 was performed was that she was required to be referred by her treating doctor, and that treating doctor was Dr. Chambers. And I believe, based on the record, that was her visit to that doctor, to the hospital for that second mammogram, based on the hospital procedures, had to be based
she
upon.
She went to see him, or she called him, and he sent her to the hospital for that second mammogram?
Based on the evidence we received for the deposition testimony, which is a part of the record from the hospital. The hospital then merely provided the physical facilities and the equipment to perform the diagnostic test. The radiologist, based in that community, simply interpreted the test. The results were never discussed with the patient, and particularly not with Mrs. Conaway. And the reports based on the diagnostic test were automatically, it wasn't just simply a courtesy copy. According to the summary judgment proof, the report was automatically sent to the referring physician, in this case Dr. Chambers, because any follow-up with regard to discussions with the patients, review of the results, decisions with regard to further diagnostic tests were that of the treating doctor.
That's June 16, 1986. He was diagnosed March 16, 1988. But there's no question that there was no malignancy diagnosed June 16, 1980. No malignancy indicated in that mammogram.
The mammogram was reported as negative. She did have a mass in her breast. The radiologist testified that he performed a sonogram because there were some items in the mammogram that were of concern to him. And although the sonogram was not diagnostic for cancer, he did perform a sonogram to attempt to determine whether or not the mass was a cyst. He could not identify a cyst, and therefore he did the follow-up test because there were some concerns that he had based on the mammogram results, because there was a palpable mass. He was not able to identify it as cancerous based on the mammogram. He did some further, did a sonogram. He then sent the report. It's also very important to recognize that the radiologist, in one of his reports to Dr. Chambers, recommended rechecks at 1 year in the future.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
In that regard, from June 16 of 86 to March 16 of 88, Ms. Conaway had 7 office visits for a variety of reasons, flus, colds, other ailments. Did she, at any of those visits, alert the doctor of complaint, the doctor of any pain in her breast or any abnormality in her breast?
No, she did not, Your Honor, and she, in her deposition...
Did she state in her deposition that she, during this interim, was confirmed because of pain or abnormality?
She did not have complaints of pain. She noticed the lump that she had was the same lump that had been previously tested on 2 occasions, and she had been informed by the defendant that it was nothing to be concerned of. She knew that the doctor was aware of it. She knew from her relationship with this doctor that he would alert her as to when something else needed to be done. Very similar to what he did with regard to her blood sugar, her high blood pressure, and those things. And according to her deposition testimony...
Counsel, didn't you say, though, that during this period that she there were changes?
She noticed the...
She noticed changes.
She testified that she did notice...
Was there any explanation as to why she did not discuss those changes with us?
The only explanation was that she provided was that she was relying on Dr. Chambers to alert her.
If there's a change in condition.
The change, as she describes it in her deposition, is not one where from prior to May of 1986, there's no change, and then suddenly a change occurs. The condition, the lump, was present in 1983. And over that time period, the But based on her deposition testimony, she gradually grew.
During the June 1686 to March 1688 period, there were changes, I believe, that she had observed in the condition of the breast. But during that period, she did not discuss those changes with Dr. Tanner.
No. The only discussion that she had was at some point, which is unidentified in the record, after the May 13, 1986 mammogram, that Dr. Chambers advised her that it looked like everything was fine. Whether that occurred on the June 16, 1986 visit or one of the other subsequent visits.
That was a mammogram, or what?
Yes.
That was a comment on that report. It wasn't a comment on any new examination that you had made.
No. No, it was not.
So
it was,
there was nothing to alert him to look again or to ask for even a third mammogram during that period.
Other than the fact that his patient was continuing to complain of a lump in his breast, he had been advised through the sonogram report that she needed to be
rechecked. I'm talking about during 1686 to March 1688. During the period, there were changes in the breast.
Yes.
That she had observed.
Yes.
And she did not say anything to him about that.
No, she did not. The information that Dr. Chambers would have had would have been the information that he was provided from his discussions with her at the time the mammograms were done.
So why then did she decide to go to this other Tyler group where the diagnosis was actually made?
The only explanation that she could give, Your Honor, is that she went in March of 1988, and the only explanation she could provide, and as she did in her deposition, was that she felt that the Lord had told her that she needed to go someplace else, and that occurred shortly before her going to the University of Texas Health Center in Tyler.
But the Lord hadn't told her, she ought to say something about it to her doctor.
Apparently not, Your Honor. And the...
Why is it not true that the rule which you advocate in this case would mean that there would be no effective limitation period in an ongoing physician patient?
Well, the court in Roundtree has set forth some specific factors to be considered and specifically stated that these cases need to be reviewed on a case-specific, or the fact-specific basis. The factors that the court has set forth in Roundtree are to determine whether or not the patient has received the course of treatment and when it ended, or was doctor-patient relationship established as to the condition. Did the doctor continue to treat or attend to the patient? And was the condition such that it required future services from the physician? And those factors, I think, would need to be reviewed to determine, based on the facts of some specific case, as to whether or not the patient has continued to receive a course of treatment and whether or not that treatment has ended.
But it's not your position then that the rule should be as broad as whenever there is continuing care on a general nature, limitations are not.
I think APA and the other cases have settled that with regard to where a party has come in and attempted to purely rely upon the existence of a doctor-patient relationship as to running or the tolling, the running of the statute of limitations, but no claim is made as with regard to negligence during the subsequent course of treatment that it will not apply. In this particular case, we have made specific allegations of negligence on the part of the defendant up through and continuing to the period of relapse of visit upon the doctor on January 18, 1988. And as was held in the Roundtree versus Hunsucker case, in a misdiagnosis case, the statute of limitations begins to run on the date that the doctor last had an opportunity to perform an examination and to diagnose the condition. And in this particular case, based upon the principles that were set forth in Roundtree versus Hunsucker, That date was January 18, 1988, a date clearly within the limitations period. And the, with regard to the questions concerning the defendant, there would tend to argue that the only way that he can be negligent is by some affirmative act, which totally abrogates the definition of negligence. In ordinary care is including an act or omission. We are talking about a condition of which this defendant had noticed the relationship between this doctor and patient, where over the course of the years, the patient relied upon the doctor and knew from his own practice and custom that he would use his judgment and alert her to when something else needed to be done.
You can see that the Court of Appeals was wrong in remanding the case, saying there's a question of fact as to when the cause of action accrued?
I think they, I do not believe that the Court of Appeals was incorrect in remanding the case, Your Honor. I do not believe
the case should be remanded so the jury could determine when treatment ended.
Well,
but if in fact, as you said in Hunsucker, that's a question of law, wasn't the Court of Appeals wrong in at least remanding for that reason? I understand you think this case should be remanded for trial on the merits, but wasn't the Court of Appeals wrong under Roundtree for remanding a case to determine when the cause of action accrued?
If I understand the point that you're attempting to make, then yes, they would have been incorrect on that point. The point that the Court of Appeals made was that if there was going to be no further treatment, particularly in the context of the custom between this doctor and this patient and the context of the relationship between the other healthcare providers and this doctor in this community, that if the doctor was not going to treat and the patient could not rely upon what her experience had been with him, then he should have advised her that I do not intend to treat your breast, so that, yes, the course of treatment was ended. I think in that context, no, the Court of Appeals was not incorrect if that was the doctor's intent. We have a very case-specific situation here where the patient over many years had relied upon the doctor because of his superior knowledge, medical judgment, to alert her to the conditions and treatment that may be necessary for conditions of which he had noticed. We're not dealing with a situation where he wasn't aware that there was some significant problem in this lady's breast. The radiologist who testified that the mammogram and the sonogram are not conclusive, and it's very clear from the testimony of that radiologist as well as the hospital that further follow-up was clearly anticipated on the part of them, but that based upon the relationship between these healthcare providers in that community, that follow-up was the responsibility of the defendant, and that's why he was provided with that report, and this lady wouldn't have even been allowed to come in and have the test done absent the referral from some primary care physician such as Dr. Chambers.
You indicated earlier that the radiologist in providing the mammogram report to the doctor suggested continuing annual examinations.
Yes, he suggests because she had
He was, in effect, put on notice that this is something you need to follow up on.
Yes.
And you need to monitor this situation.
Because of her age, because of the changes that they found within the fibrocystic disease that they found within the breast that was picked up by the mammogram, and which in some instances can mask the presence of cancer or hide it, he recommended expressly in his report that she be rechecked within a year. We are talking about a course of treatment which is fully anticipated.
And she continued to see him on at least 6 or 7 occasions during the next 2.5 years, and no examination of that sort was ever conducted.
That's correct. And that report, which recommended those further examinations and rechecks was a report that went exclusively to Dr. Chambers and was not provided to Mrs. Conaway. The hospital kept a copy for themselves, but that report went to the treating doctor, and it was the responsibility of the treating doctor to then take that information and then use his medical judgment with regard to a proper course of future follow-up care. That was not discussed with Mrs. Conaway herself. Mrs. Conaway was under the misinformation that mammogram was a
clean bill of health.
Clean bill of health. She'd gone in twice and gotten a clean bill of health.
So I guess what you're saying is that when she went in for these other maladies, other treatments during the next 2.5 years, even though there was continuing change in her breast condition, she assumed that if the doctor had any concern about it, he would ask her about it.
Yes.
Or whatever.
Yes, and that was the custom and practice between this doctor and his patients, particularly Mrs. Conaway. She might come in with the flu or complaints with regard to her back, and he would advise her, it's been a year, or it's been a year and a half since I checked your blood sugar. We need to do that today. And that was the course of practice that was established between them. She knew that he was aware of the problems, the lump in her breast, and it was her understanding that when it came time for that follow-up care to occur, because she was in to see him regularly, that he would so alert her and follow up. She has, other than the explanation that...
Up in the same 2.5 years, I apologize, but it's more like a...
Almost...
More like a... Less than 2 years.
It is a little bit less than 2 years. She went in to see him on June 16, 1986. She then was in to see him another half a dozen times, running through 1987, the last visit being January 19th of 1988. The subsequent to that time, and the only explanation she could give is that she felt the Lord had told her that she needed to go to Tyler. And that's where she went, where an immediate diagnosis was made of breast cancer. It advanced to a stage that it had spread into her lymph nodes. They were unable to see, because of the advanced spread of the disease, they were unable to remove all of the cancer through the surgery. Based on the summary judgment proof that we had submitted, the delay in the discovery of her breast cancer permitted it to reach an advanced stage, thereby decreasing her chances of survival and ultimate recovery from the cancer.
What is this Conaway's age?
Conway is in her, I believe she's in her late 60s.
So she would have been in her 50s or...
I believe she was in her 60s at the time this occurred, so she's in her very late 60s, early 70s at this point in time. The medical protocol at that point, particularly where fibrocystic disease has been developed, would suggest continued monitoring of it and then a decision by the healthcare provider as to whether either follow-up mammograms, biopsies, or a referral to a specialist should occur at some subsequent date.
Thank you.
As I listen to counsel's argument, I'm reminded of the same argument in round three. In round three, the same argument was made. You failed to monitor my occluded arteries. You failed to further test. You failed to do this.
The doctor never undertook to treat the occluded arteries in the first instance in round three.
He actually examined her and made a notation that there was no occluded arteries. So that occurred.
The argument there was that the medication, the prescription for medication, because of high blood pressure, told or the statute of limitations, but he never treated her for occluded arteries per se.
But they also argued that he failed to test for occluded arteries during the time he was given this medication. You failed to monitor me for occluded arteries during the time you're giving me this medication to treat my high blood pressure. So this court was faced with the same issue, and that's what I interpreted this court to hold. Mere presence of a general physician-patient relationship does not operate to total extent.
Was this mere presence here, though? Did, in fact, the mammogram conducted in 1986, did, in fact, the radiologist's report suggest that further testing and follow-up would be necessary on an annual basis?
My recollection, Your Honor, is that occurred in the first mammogram of 83, but not in the second mammogram of 1986. Again, Your Honor, I might have to refer back to the file because I don't know the specific answer whether that was the 83 or the 86. But I don't think the 86 made that recommendation. But even if it did, suppose one physician recommends to another, I want you to follow this course of action, and the other physician decides I don't want to do it, or I don't think it's proof. Does it operate from the time, just like Roundtree, does it operate each and every time you said over the next 4 years I want you to prescribe exercise program? I mean, is this physician held in a limited statute that extends over 4 years? No, I think it occurs from the time they make some judgment and has the opportunity. And the opportunity comes
when he has some symptomology or something that causes him to treat that breath.
But when a physician, a family physician, in say treats a man over the course of his lifetime, fails to ever conduct a physical examination to detect prostate cancer, or to order clinical blood tests, test the enzyme level, whatever the newest state of the art is with regard to detection of prostate cancer, you would say that limitations would bar any claim that the doctor should have performed those tests but did not, as long as it occurred, he should have performed them more than 2 years before the date of suit.
Under this theory, that's what the Spicer case, which was cited as part of the Microchip case in Roundtree, that's the fact situation. It's essentially the same fact situation as this. And that court held that the failure to continue to follow up on prostate examinations after you originally do one and conclude there's no cancer.
I'm talking about not the failure to follow up, but the failure to ever perform one in the first instance.
I think it would go back to the time he conducted his examination and should have done that. In other words, whenever he undertook
to give an overall general examination to make that decision. But if he's in there treating the flu, why should he be held to standards of patient's complaints way back here?
Well, doesn't the doctor have a duty to determine whether a patient may be suffering from a condition which is undetectable to the layperson?
Again, I think we're getting back to the round we started in the beginning. But the answer to that question is yes, I think the doctor has a duty, but the doctor has the duty to treat what he's presented with. And he's presented in this case with flu. Now, if the patient comes in for preventative care, such as the high blood pressure example, when does the operative phase run?
Was it the practice between this doctor and this patient for him to suggest to her that I haven't checked your blood sugar or I haven't checked your blood pressure a long time, if we need to do that again? Was this indeed the relationship that they had that he indicated when some examination, diagnosis, or treatment was necessary for something that they had been monitoring before, and that she may have relied on him when it should be done again?
I don't know about the reliance aspect that you added on the last part, but they had established a continuing course of treatment for the high blood pressure, unless since she has a heart attack. You know, I think you're going to find that. But the question I've got, Judge, I want to follow up because you hit a point that I want to follow up on, is suppose he quits doing that. Suppose he never again gives her another test for high blood pressure. In 2 years and 3 months after that date, while he's in treatment for flu, but never again follows up that care, when's he held liable? He's held liable from the time of the last high blood pressure test. And that's what this court, I think, held in Roundtree.
Any other questions? One last question. I think if you dispute the standard of care testified to by Dr. Fong.
Yes.
Just to close this case,
Y'all have to please rise.